Hi, I'm Matt Waller, Dean of the Sam M. Walton College of Business. Welcome to Be Epic, the podcast where we explore excellence, professionalism, innovation, and collegiality, and what those values mean in business, education, and your life today. I have with me today Rebecca Garner, who has been involved in portfolio management and finance for most of her career. And do you go by Becca?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate it. So Becca, I know you've been involved in finance for most of your career. Have you always been interested in finance? How did you get interested in it?
No. $25 a month is what put me in the investment business instead of insurance. I left school. My friends badgered me, and so I moved to Dallas. I left school. My buddies that were there were working in an insurance company. My roommate in college's sister worked at a bank, Republic National Bank. I went to interview that Monday, and the insurance company offered me a job at $300 a month, and the bank offered me a job at $325 a month. I didn't know how lucky I was. I mean, I didn't know that Alan Greenspan didn't talk to everybody all the time. I didn't know that Ross Perot didn't come by everybody's office. I was the personal research assistant to the head of the trust investment department, Edmund A. Menes, and he was one of the founders kind of the CFA program. It was called something else, ICMA or something like that, and then it became CFA. I didn't know what I was walking into. I mean, I thought that was what everybody did. And he did all his forecasting. He was a corporate profits specialist, expert, really. And Greenspan said, you can have my service for free. And it was a very expensive at the time. This is before he was in public service. This is Townsend Greenspan was his company. And he said, if you will just forecast with me. And he said, okay. So Kathy Eichhoff was head of his office. I didn't know everybody didn't talk to her every day. I was really lucky to be in the right place at the right
time.
That's
amazing. But you must have really liked it because you spent your whole career in finance.
It suited me. I had to find the area of finance, of the business that suited me. And it's like I tell my friends, but it has taken every job to get me to where I wanted to be. For instance, I was in sales some, and I was very successful. Investment banking, very successful. Didn't suit me. I didn't like it. I didn't love getting up every day. The pace wasn't right for me. Female in the business, that had its downs. And so I wanted something that, you know, there's nothing subjective. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want a job where it's totally not subjective. Portfolio management did that for me. And I went to Little Rock because it was a personal thing. I had a chance to have my little sister for a year. Didn't want to have her in Houston. And T.J. Rainey, which was a O-line firm in Little Rock, had been after me to come up there and work for them, be their first female, you know, kind of thing. And I had a chance to have her, and so I did that for a year. And then when she left, I tried sales and I did investment banking and I made a good bit of money, but I didn't like it. So I had a friend call me. The Mercantile Exchange was having problems in that, did you ever go on the floor when everything had to take place by open outcry? I worked there at that time. Well, one of the problems they were having, I mean, it was like a size of a football field with 4,000 people and every one of them or 95% of them were misfits. I mean, this was the oddest group of people you've ever been around in your life. What they found as the business grew, the futures business grew, was that these people only had experience in futures. And if they wanted to grow, they had to have people who could talk to them. So they were really up for people with cash experience. And so I had a girlfriend up there who wound up actually over all of J.P. Morgan's stuff. But she said, Becca, you just got to come. And she knew I was unhappy. So I said, okay. And it happened to be, I was there for 3 months. It felt like 5 years. But the S&P pit opened then. That was wild day. I kept hearing this, a coach's whistle? And finally I said, what is going on over there? He said, well, every time they start, they're trading. It is open. They are trading. But every time they realize, because it's a pretty big pit, that if they're trading at different prices, they blow the whistle. Oh, those other ones still work, but they had to start over kind of. I mean, it was like nuts. There was what's called an exchange disease. everybody walked around pretty much with a Lysol thing. You pick up the phone and maybe this bank is all yours, only your people. But you get so sick, everybody would do that. I mean, it was awful. It was awful.
How long did you do that?
3 months. But I know that sounds like a real short time. But when you know what I had to do, with cash experience, no futures experience, you are relegated to logging trades for like 2 weeks. You got to know symbols. You got to know the people, who your workers are, that kind of thing. Well, I caught these guys. I mean, there was no question about it. Some of the $2 brokers that traded through us were stealing. I mean, they were putting the good trades, they were keeping the good trades and, you know, and waiting. You're not supposed to ever wait on a trade. That's, you know, the time was an issue. But they were putting the losing trades in the owner's account. Now, my firm, GNP Commodities. So finally, I figured, you know, I'm sorry, but I can't just watch this go. I have to go tell these guys. It's two brothers. They own the place. And my friend, Robin, who dropped me up, she's back. I wouldn't if I were you. And I said, well, I have to. I can't not do this. So I went up and told them. They acted surprised. In retrospect, they probably weren't surprised. But they wanted me to keep doing this so that I could monitor that situation. I said, no, I'm not a watchdog. That's not what I'm here for. I've told you what I know. My time is up on logging, and I'm done with that. And so, but they never did a thing to the, I mean, it is a strange place. It was a strange place. But what really got me to leave, I mean, I was miserable. I was on your feet all day. They had a document. It was like 5 typewritten pages on what you could or couldn't wear on the floor, because these people would just break all the boundaries. I mean, at one point there were like 50 kinds of shoes you could not wear. And other than dress shoes, don't ask me why, all of a sudden they added Reebok tennis shoes, only Reebok. It was like the strangest place in the world. But then all of a sudden I get this call, and I'm on the floor. Now, you're talking, everything's open outcry. It's screaming. It's loud.
Year was that?
1982.
Okay.
1982, fall of 1982, because I started working for Lee. I get a call from Lee Bodenhammer. I don't know him. I mean, I kind of knew who he was. He's from near my hometown. He's from El Dorado. But I was coming home for Christmas. This was in December, early December. And so he asked me lunch. He said, I want to talk to you about it. He had a portfolio management job he wanted to talk to me about. And so, okay, I'll talk to you. Because I'm thinking there was also some personal stuff with a guy I was not dating, but I finally relented and I said, I'll date you, but he's down there. I'd left to get away, and I wound up marrying him, but what do you do? what can you do? So at any rate, I had lunch with Lee, and he offered me this job for First Variable Life, the company he started.
Lee Bodenhammer was inducted into the Arkansas Business Hall of Fame.
And he's got the Bodenhammer Scholars.
And the Bodenhammer Scholars,
yeah,
that's a huge scholarship
program. Oh, yeah.
Bodenhammer Fellowships, they give 5 to 6 of them per year. They're $18,000 per year. All majors are considered. You have to have a minimum of a 32 ACT and a 3.8 GPA in high school. But you've got to really demonstrate leadership to be able to get this. It's very competitive, but it's a very generous gift. And, there's a lot of them. So
the only thing was, when I got there, I said, I'd do it. I started working January the 5th, I think it was, 83. I started looking at that portfolio. And let's say it's $230 million, something like that. Not monster, but back then that was a decent-sized portfolio. There were probably 300 names, and probably 60 to 70% of it was junk. I'd never done junk bonds in my life. He didn't tell me it was junk bond portfolio. Who can watch 300 bonds, 300 issues? Nobody. But he started the company only buying, because he's an equity guy all the way. Oh, and he's good at it. He would only buy off the floor. And there's only fives and 7 and 10, you know, because it was when they first started the company. And so he had all these names. I know I probably ought to go in and do all the research, but I can't. I'm going to have to just go by the ratings. So I did nothing but consolidation trades for 6 months to get it down manageable so that I could actually really now delve into some of the credits. Now, but I'm still faced with, I don't know anything about junk bonds. Well, I go there in January, and the next month is the conference, the Drexel conference. I got to go. I have to. I've got to meet some of these people. I've got to, you know, hear some of the stories. I got to know something about this. Lee said, no, it's too expensive. I said, okay, Lee, you pay for my trip out there if I can find a place to stay. And he said, okay, I'll do that. Because probably a night at the Wilshire is more expensive than the plane, you know. But I have a friend that lived in Beverly Hills. She was one of my bridesmaids, so I knew I had a place to stay. So I went there. This was one of the turning points of my life. The last night there, last day there, they always did something. It started on a Wednesday morning, and it went till Saturday at noon. And when I say it was nonstop, it was nonstop. It was, I mean, everything was just, you hit the wall like Thursday afternoon. But a lot of people would leave early. Well, he didn't want anybody leaving early, Mike Milken. So he had, I guess, a keynote speaker the last day at noon that everybody was like gaga about. I didn't know about this guy, but seems that he's not a recluse, but he never spoke. He wasn't out there. He was a co-founder of Teledyne and then went to be the dean of the business school at the University of Texas, George Kosmetsky. And so that was our speaker, and everybody was gaga about this guy. And at this point, there were like 300 people. The Drexel conference at the end was like 4,000 people. There were 300 people at the Wilshire, and there's only two women there, me and the girl from Wellesley. And we used to change our tags out all the time, confuse people. But he got up there, and Milken, when he'd start his conference, always did a free form, no notes or anything, just talking about what he sees in the future. And not just our business, but what he sees or needs in neighborhoods. So George Kosmetsky gets up and he gives the same type of thing about the future. And of course, the industry he, you know, started was that kind of a company. I mean, he started talking about that. Now it's the Q&A. Now, understand that the Drexel conference is early on, not so much later. Because I asked a friend of mine who's portfolio manager at Mass Financial, I said, hey, tell me this. Are these guys, these analysts that you have, are part of their bonuses based on whether they ask the best questions? She said, yeah. I mean, so this is real serious competition when it gets to Q&A, okay? So the Q&A to George Kosmetsky. Oh, I guess we'd had 3 or 4 or 5. And one guy said, he said, I have a question. He said, what do you think's going to be make the biggest impact on this business, the junk bond business? He did not hesitate. Women. My friend and I looked at each other, and they said, why women? He said, because they don't have a good old boy network. They're going to question everything you do. People have no idea the role we played in junk bonds. No idea how we were very serious about junk bonds. I mean, to give you an example, people don't understand this. Yeah, I know Drexel had a monopoly, but that was junk bond at its finest, because they did, it was so, the ones, the good ones are such easy sales. Why even touch a bad one? Why even look at them? Just shoo them out the door. It's only when DLJ didn't disrupt it as much as people like a Merrill, who never going to specialize in it. Rothschild did a good job, but they only would bring 2 or 3 a year, you know. So at any rate, an example, great. This is a small little piece of what we could do.
Because you didn't have the good old boy network.
No, not at all. But we got to know each other. I mean, we would meet each other. There weren't that many of us, but they grew. But like one time, do you remember when Shearson Lehman tried to bring RJR,
yeah,
Nabisco, and it all blew up. I can't remember the year, but Metropolitan bought a single A credit, Nabisco, or RJR, one of the two, RJR. I guess it was RJR. Nabisco didn't have credit, in like April of that year, a single A credit, they'd bought a bunch of bonds. Now we're in September. There's no way they couldn't have known this was in the works. There's no way, no way. So Metropolitan, who now is going to have a single B or double B credit versus what they just bought 4 months ago, 5 months ago, sued the heck out of Schuster & Lehman and RJR and those people. So the whole thing fell apart. Well, now go forward another 5 or 6 months to like March, KKR and Drexel came to the market, did a deal. Well, they had added three words in the prospectus that should be there. Didn't blame them. You know, there's always a thing in there that says they're absolving the officers and directors, board members of any liability for this issue kind of thing. Well, they added, or its creation. And I can't blame them. Too many lawsuits out there. They didn't start this mess. You know, they're wrapping it up and finishing it, but it wasn't their deal. So I didn't have a problem with that. They tried to make that a boilerplate statement. Not on my watch. You can't, you know, that happens a lot. So, you know, I mean, I was mad about this. And he didn't know how mad I was. Well, there's a girl at New York Teachers, TIA Craft, Teresa Weizemerski. And Teresa, I wasn't 5'2". She had kind of sandy colored hair and it was curly. She had kind of a high voice. She dressed like a little doll, you know, kind of thing. But she was tough as nails, but she was a great girl. I called Teresa. I said, Teresa, you know, they're not going to come to Little Rock and on a road show. I said, but we got a problem here. And I explained it to her. And it's a new issue had come out that they'd done this, and I can't remember which one it was, but it was in there. And she said, really? Because believe it or not, I was one of the few that actually read all the prospectuses. So at any rate, they turned to me. And so she said, okay, I'm going to the lunch tomorrow. I'll let you know what happens. She called me back. She was laughing. She said, they were so arrogant that they left under everybody's chair a prospectus. So when she asked her little question in her little cute voice and said, because nobody had even noticed it. And so we got long, and so then they all picked them up and said, you can hear the paper. She said, these guys were dying up there. They did not. I mean, it wasn't a big deal, and it wasn't, but it could have been. So you can't let it stay. So those are the kind of things we would get done pretty quietly. I got those three words out of every prospectus but two. We could do that. And we did it quietly. But seriously, we did it. DLJ, when they came into business, you know, they were the next big player. Well, I had been real careful. But I did support DLJ. I thought, I mean, I did business with them too. I mean, everybody. So when their first conference, and those were the big deals with conferences back then. Oh, yeah. They tried to outdo each other to an extent you would not believe. I was at the first conference, and they were having the first kind of, let's talk about this, you know, like opening ceremony, whatever. And my salesman happened to be female. She was one of the best salesmen I ever had. They said, Becca, can you come up here? Do you mind sitting up the front? And I said, well, no. They put me right by Dick Jeanrette, who is a great guy, by the way. But they wanted to show that they were serious. And I felt like they'd been really good to me. I said, okay, I'll sit up there. I mean, they knew what to do. Because then people would call me and ask me, what are your dealings with DLJ? I mean, but they were doing a good job. They had a lot of their resources going toward that business. So I knew they were really serious, and they were. And then Lee sold the company in 1985. The thing closed in September 30th of 1985. I had my daughter on September 25th, 1985. I'm 9 months pregnant. Only two of us, Monarch bought them. They had two insurance companies, Monarch Life and Springfield Life, all up in Massachusetts and Vermont. And then they bought First Variable. Well, they convinced me to stay. Now, I'm in Little Rock. I've got a 17-page document contract that says I don't have to move more than 50 miles out of Little Rock. They made a big deal out of it, but they didn't want me up there. I was female. I'm serious. They didn't. You go up there, you don't see a female except at the Secretary of Death. And so it worked out great for all of us.
So you were very early as a female getting into this investment finance.
I was the second female to ever be in the bond business in Texas.
Wow.
In the state of Texas, yeah. Sherry was the first one, and she and I were friends. And I took her place when she left the bank at Houston National Bank. She actually wound up on the sell side and loved it. Just wasn't my thing.
Now, junk bonds are non-investment grade,
right?
High risk.
No, not necessarily not high necessarily. Risk.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about junk bonds?
Junk bond is, you've got the A's, AAA being the highest, U.S. Treasury, double A's, hardly any exist, single A, a lot of those, triple B. Those are the investment grade categories. Double B is a junk bond. That's a pretty good credit. That's the high grade of junk. Single B is so varied, you could drive a Mack truck through. Why this got an A, a B, and this got a B too? I mean, because you get into the C's and nobody's going to touch them. You see what I mean? Because that's just a little too junky. So there's really only one credit, and that was a single B. Because they did all these CLOs and that kind of thing, the collateralized loan obligations, those things, and they were required to have double Bs. So that market wasn't very big to begin with, and so there was already taken up. So single B was pretty much it.
Now, the junk bond market really...
I mean, like Safeway, that was a junk bond. A lot of its names, you know, they just don't have very slim margins. You're not much equity, and you have to watch them a lot more closely.
And they need credit, too.
Sure they do. There were a lot of good credits.
It is true, though, a lot of people, when they hear junk bond, they think of something that isn't positive, even though it's an important
market. Well, they're really called high-yield bonds.
Yeah.
Junk was the nickname, if you will. But I will tell you how serious it got. People did get too complacent. Like one of the guys on the Monarch board, have you ever heard of Aldrich, Eastman, and Walsh? Mm-hmm. Real estate guys? All right, Peter Aldrich was on our board. And Peter asked me to do him a favor. I said, what do you want? And he was having a conference for all his clients down at Epcot Center. He said, Beck, I need you to scare them a little bit. They're too complacent. They need to kind of, pay more attention. So I said, all right, I'll go down and scare them a little bit. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I never do when I'm speaking on that kind of thing. So I wanted to see who the guys were. And I saw Owens, Illinois, and I saw all these others. So I stood up there, and I made them nervous because I told them what the street talked, what they called their bonds, the nicknames and that kind of thing. Owens, Illinois was the lawyers. The Lawyers Full Employment Act, They had no idea how they were perceived in the street by the traders and not necessarily portfolio managers.
Now, talk about a little, just for a moment, about Mike Milken's role in junk bonds.
He was with another small firm. It became Drexel Burnham, but he was with the one that was taken in. And I can't think of it. It was a little baby firm. He was traveling. Where was he going to school? I think going to school at Wharton or something at nights. And so he would have a headlamp like a miner would use and read prospectuses. He created this market, and he didn't have a market. But he convinced them to let him sell this, and he was going to put all his efforts toward it. But if he was going to do this, he wanted 25% of the profits of this little company. He was still getting that when they were bringing in $5 billion. In retrospect, if you never know they're there, you don't know that they're cheating you, right? They didn't all do it. I mean, like Rothschild, I bought Triangle Corp and they came with warrants priced at $5. I sold them at almost $100. You know, I mean, they were worth a lot. He was distributing them to his buddies, the warrants, not even telling the marketplace. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. You can be his buddy, which is dangerous in and of itself, was. I knew it. I mean, you know it. And so, or, you know, and maybe get some of this kind of thing, or you don't ever know about it. He did it a lot. Yeah. Occasionally he'd put something in that they just needed to get rid of. Well, people like Joni Batchelder, who's Mass Financial, we'd have lunch on Wednesday every year for the conference. And she told me one day, I mean, she was just depressed. I said, what is wrong? She said, Becca, I'm so big I can't not buy anything. That's hard. Think about that. I can't not buy anything. That's scary. Now that is scary. Yeah. Oh, and she knew it. She was depressed. I think she'd been trying to get them to shut the fund down so it's a mutual fund. Of course, they're not going to do it. The golden goose kind of thing.
Mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Okay, so a couple of things I wanted to make sure we covered. I'd like you to talk just a little bit more about women in finance and your experience.
I didn't realize how tough it was when I was going through it. I'm going to tell you that right now. I didn't realize what it should have been. Or what it could have been. But I will say, there were no female mentors. That didn't exist. But I had fabulous men mentors. I did. I had some, they just went the extra mile. When I left, I went to Whitewell after the bank. And they just hired me because they heard I was leaving the bank. And I just refused to stay. I didn't want to get vested. I knew I'd never leave if I got vested. And I had to go. There was no place for me to go at the bank, Trust Investment Department, no place to go. So the head of the office, he said, Becca, are you leaving? I said, yeah. And he said, where are you going? I said, I don't know. I don't have a job. That's how important this is to me. He said, I'll hire you. I said, what am I going to do? And he said, I don't know yet, but I'll hire you. I said, okay. So my first project was... they were about to be losing some of their territory. He said, can you look into this and see what you can do to help me here? Now, understand, there are no PowerPoints. There's nothing like that. Everything is by hand. When I was doing bonds, I'd have to go clip coupons in Lee's office. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is absolutely everything's by hand. I wound up, it took me about 6 weeks to gather all the data and make all the charts in colored pencil. But I not only did they not lose territory, they gained some. So, because I could make the case for them. And then I worked on the syndicate desk. I worked on the whatever. Well, and I was working with institutional stock guys, but right next to the bond guys. Okay, so we're like this. And so I wanted to get my, I thought I would be interested in getting my Series 7. That kind of thing. Now, this was a time when they were sending people to New York for, 6 months to a year in training classes. Oh, yeah.
I didn't know it was that long.
Oh, a long time. Yes. The guys were gone for a long time, and they would all talk about the apartment that they rented. And when I said I wanted to get mine, and these are people who supported me and were great friends, he handed me the SEC, the legal book of all the rules. So it pissed me off so much. I passed the test, having that as my only guide. I did. I had all the rules and regs, all that stuff. Now, I didn't need it. I just wanted it to learn and stuff. But then I had a chance to go to a bond house my first time there. Well, I was nervous. Back then, it was bond book. I only had bond books. Okay, that's all you had. I didn't know anything about bonds. I didn't know anything about a bond book. The head of the office and the two bond guys and preferred guys sat there and taught me for 2 weeks all about bonds. And I wound up going over there. What we did was, you know what a sinking fund is? Well, they were very active back then, and we had a patented sinking fund book. A little company called Stewart Brothers, started by two brothers that actually were angels on Broadway. and West Side Story, I think, was one of their investments. I mean, they were good guys. But we were known as an odd lot house. But really, our business was the sinking funds. Biggest account in the business, in this company, nationwide, was Employees Retirement System in Texas. It was my account. I will tell you, I got a call after I left the sell side about 30 years later and said, Becca, this is a voice out of your past. I said, Danny Boswell. It was him. He said, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. He said, did you leave the sell side because of me? I said, yes, Danny, I did.
Did he apologize?
Yeah, he did. And I was nice, and I accepted it. I was graceful about it. I never said, you know, but I did leave that part of the business. I just had enough. Just had enough. He was a sinking fund player. He would accumulate against the sinker. And if you wanted to do that, you had to have our book. If you wanted to do that, you had to have our knowledge of, yeah, it looks like that you can't accumulate about everybody. You know, you can't do that. So there are some people who are more prone to do it. Some companies more prone to get behind or more, but you can look and see that. You have to know their mindsets. You have to know these people. And our guy did. He knew these people really well. I can't do that anymore. There's mainly a gas, and they don't do that much anymore. But back then, that was a big business. And he made a lot of money.
Now, you also did other types of portfolio management types of work. But is there anything you'd want to say about your time at Llama?
Oh, sure. I had been obliquely told about that, that maybe that could be a job. And I'd said, no, I'm not interested. You know, I have my own business and I'm really not interested. So I'd really never let it go any further than somebody just very obliquely doing this. Well, I was getting a divorce. I didn't want to stay in Little Rock. But I didn't want to be so far that my daughter couldn't see her dad every other weekend. So the Minneapolis job, that was going to would have been a great job, but it was just too far. Jacksonville, too far. These are offers I had. Then I get out of the blue, I get this call from a headhunter in Houston. He just said it was in Northwest Arkansas. I didn't know who it was. And I said, I'll talk to him. That's strictly a location thing, right? He's on my doorstep the next morning. And it finally comes out that it's Alice. I said, okay, I'll talk to her. I mean, I'll talk to her. So I went up and talked to her. And I mean, I was put it all on the line. I said, Alice, you got to know. My daughter is 9. She's going to come first no matter what. She said, that's not a problem for me. And it never was. Matter of fact, Alice and my daughter are good buddies. But I called her and we went and they played.
Wow.
No, I mean, she had no problem with that. She said it and she meant it.
What's your daughter's name?
Jordan.
I think I've met her.
Oh, you did? You met her at the she was with the Tysons? She just took a job with the Tysons?
Yeah.
And she was with Olivia and John Randall?
Yeah, where was John? I met them?
At the... down Little Rock.
At Arkansas Business Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Sometimes
tall, blonde.
Yeah.
That's my daughter.
Oh, okay. Yeah, she seemed like a really
neat she's person. The best. She's the best. So at any rate, I talked to her because she was really more broker-dealer side. That was her thing, was the broker-dealer side. I knew that this was a risk. But it really wasn't. She needed me, somebody like me that had the reputation I had. And I needed to be within a certain amount of distance of my ex-husband. It worked out fine. You know what I mean? So my whole company came up with me. I sold my company to her. Well, you know, there's two ways to sell your company. You can sell the company because they don't have an ADV or whatever. That's what the Garrisons did. They bought the company. Alice bought my assets and took all of us as employees. So I did go up there. So did it take me about 6 months to say I'm with Llama without a lump in my throat? Yeah, it took me about that long. They were really good to me. They were fair to me. I'm not saying Alice was an angel, nor was I, but nobody is.
Right.
Come on.
That's exactly right.
She's tough. I will tell you this. That girl knows balance sheets back and forth. She can tear apart a balance sheet and all those financials like you've never seen. She is like a, she's really good at that. It's amazing. But no, I was one of the few, because a lot of people had started different parts of the business that could be broken off. You know, she wouldn't do it. She's just going to shut it down when she was ready to shut it down. But she let me buy mine back.
Wow.
And she said, well, I said, what do you want? She asked me, you know, what do you think it's worth? And I said, I'll sell it to you on the same term. I mean, I'll buy it in the same terms I sold it to you.
Now, tell me again the years you were there.
Hold on, 94 to 99.
So you
almost 5 years.
It's possible we met. When I was a new professor here,
mm-hmm.
I was a visiting assistant professor in 94 and 95. And I was the first person that really had a retail CPG supply chain back. Do you remember this?
No, I mean, like,
Hugo had a client in, I don't remember who, it may have been Stone Container. Does that ring a bell?
That would have been on the broker-dealer side. It wouldn't have been on my side.
Okay. Did you know Randy Laney at all while you were there?
Yeah.
He was the one that called me back then.
That's the one who told me it's a small man.
What's that?
Small mountain. Best advice I ever got.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
He's a really nice person.
Well, he was kind of, he had left Walmart, but he really didn't have a place to go, so he actually officed in my offices.
Ah.
So we got to know each other fairly well.
Yeah, he was, I really liked working
with him. But he's the one, that was his warning. Don't ever forget, it's a small mountain. And boy, that was the best advice I ever had. Because it is a small mountain.
It's very small.
Yeah. It's real small.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. And here's my daughter. She was working before the Tysons. She was with Gen 3 up there, the Generation 3 up there for like 4 or 5 years. Yeah. I told my friend, I said, oh, she just went down in market cap. Way down in market cap. From there to there. But they got her back to here.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking time.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Be Epic podcast from the Walton College. You can find us on Google, SoundCloud, iTunes, or look for us wherever you find your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe and rate us. You can find current and past episodes by searching Be Epic Podcast, one word, that's BEEPIC podcast. And now, Be Epic.